Hello, and thank you for joining Cole and I for yet another episode of Descent into Dissent. Today, we're going to do something a little different from our last episodes. Kind of wanted to break from some of the heavier topics that we've looked at and maybe take a dive into something that, at least on the surface, seems kind of innocuous. Now, we're going to frame it in the context kind of similar to our last episode, which was the story of the Garden of Eden, where Cole and I took a deep dive into the actual story in and of itself. And I know it's been a while since we have actually put out an episode, but to kind of jog your memory, the main idea there was if we suspend the belief in the story being factually and historically accurate, we're actually able to derive meaning from the story, and often in a very meaningful way, if we're able to do that. And hopefully today, Cole and I will be able to do the exact same thing with The Wizard of Oz. Now, I know I jumped right in. I forgot to even ask my co-host how he was doing today.
Oh, I'm doing great.
That's good to hear. Sorry about that.
Oh, no, you're good.
I'm pretty excited for this topic, so I figured, you know, might as well just charge straight ahead.
Now, oh, yeah, yeah.
Before we get too deep into the actual movie, The Wizard of Oz, I kind of wanted to do, I don't know if it's housekeeping, more like laying a foundation. Now, we've talked several times on here, and I know Cole and I in person have talked, and I imagine the listener has also seen this before, but our brains are set up as pattern recognition machines. And what's interesting to me is that, at least for me, it's very telling to see what patterns arise from individual brains. You know, Cole and I could probably look up at the same cloud formation, and if we see a pattern, they'd be completely different patterns. Now, I guess the question I would have for you, Cole, because I know you're a lot better in this area than I am. Do you think that previous experiences and current emotional states have anything to do with that?
Oh, absolutely. And the main thing that this hits me in life that I think a lot of people will be able to relate to is I'm kind of one of those people, and I know you are too, where we kind of go through these seasons of obsessions. So, you know, you have a lot of people who, you know, for maybe 3 months, you know, they're real obsessed with sports, or, you know, me in my case right now, it's motorcycles. You know, at another time, it might be firearms. You know, I cycle through all these obsessions. And what I find myself doing is I'll be having regular conversations, and I start to relate how do those regular conversations relate to whatever I'm obsessed with at the time. So I might be talking to somebody, and then I'll use analogies from how motorcycles work or how some company rose and fall. So because of sort of the experience I went through in my current obsession, I start to see everything through the lens of kind of where I'm at the time. And, you know, you can talk to somebody who's real into sports, I think is a real good example. And they'll be like, oh yeah, you know, it's like, we're like on the fourth down with 1 yard to go, when they're really talking about something else, because that's sort of, it's sort of the lens that they're looking through the whole world through, if that makes any sense. So they see whatever situation they are being confronted with as how it relates to the way that they're thinking at the time.
That's an interesting thought. It's something that I've seen as well, and I hadn't even really considered this episode diving into that, but it's kind of cool when you think about it that our experiences, or at least what we're currently experiencing, become so much a part of who we are. They actually become a part of our language, our vocabulary. And I don't know if it's in an effort to get other people as excited as we are about whatever we're currently obsessing, but that's an interesting point.
Yeah, it's just, I find myself doing that. Whatever I'm real into at the time, I'll overlay a pattern with whatever it is in life. And it's almost like I'm putting it in a framework that's easier for me to understand. You know, it's kind of like a slide rule for my brain so that I can work within an analogy to try to understand whatever is going on in life or in a conversation or with an obstacle, if that makes sense.
No, it does. And for me, I think and I guess I don't know that I do this, but just sitting in this chair and contemplating it now, I have to think that I do it more to get an idea across to someone else in a way that maybe they would not have understood.
Absolutely. Before. Yeah. It's a powerful tool. Like, metaphor is such a powerful tool for conveying an idea that maybe if you just explained it, like cold hard facts and stuff, they're not quite getting the connections. But when you relate it to something that seems a little more palpable, mm-hmm. then it's like all those connections get made.
Absolutely. I mean, hell, look at, you know, what we're going into here, or, you know, diving back into the Garden of Eden. The metaphors in it are what adds levity and gravity to the story. It's what makes it personal in such a way that it touches you so strongly that it communicates, I guess, in the best way.
Yeah, I would say that's what gives it impact. It makes it impactful.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's something I knew, but I mean, just talking about it now, I didn't realize that, that's absolutely a part of it. And metaphor is 100% of the impact, to use your words, of these stories. And unfortunately, I'm a bit of a nerd here, and I don't remember the name of the episode, but you probably know where I'm going already. That one on Star Trek where Picard and the
Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra.
Exactly. Yes. Yep. Exactly. Where you've got this race, for those of you that aren't nerds like us, you've got this race that communicate only in metaphor, and that is 100% of their language. And if you don't understand the stories, you don't understand what's being communicated. And metaphor is arguably what our culture, at least our language, is built upon. And what was interesting in this episode, I know it sounds like I'm driving us off a cliff here, and I'm not trying to, but Picard, of course, is not from the same planet, did not know the culture, but when the two of them were able to find similarities in metaphors, they were finally able to communicate. And I have to wonder if maybe these stories, the old stories, you know, predating Wizard of Oz, but go back to the Garden of Eden or the creation myths or religious stories or whatever the old epochs are, were ways to help cross bridges with other cultures.
Oh, I'd have to think so. And it's funny you bring that up in that manner, because kind of one of the things I wanted to touch on with the Wizard of Oz is, there's a guy named Joseph Campbell who wrote this book called A Hero of a Thousand Faces. And if you ever have heard the term the hero's journey, he's talking about how these all of these timeless tales from all of these cultures all over the world, they have a lot of these. It's basically reskinned of the same story. There's the same elements in it. And it's, you know, for whatever reason, it's so universally relatable to all humans across all cultures that all of these timeless tales seem to follow this same formula that he calls the hero's journey. And so it kind of goes to what you're saying. And it's also kind of circles back to, when we're talking about the Star Trek episode and everything, you know, that guy, to us, he would be the alien when he was trying to communicate with Picard, because their experiences were different and he was speaking so purely from the experience of his culture, Picard couldn't even understand it. So, you know, to kind of go back to your original question about how our experiences personally, or, you know, in this case, culturally, inform how we think and how we communicate, you know, I think yes, hugely. And you know, we've said, you know, this is kind of doing what we did with Garden of Eden with the Wizard of Oz, but you know, the Wizard of Oz is one of those too where it's such a part of our culture. You know, people will say like, oh, you know, I don't think we're in Kansas anymore. And it's kind of become one of those things like, I think we're going to need a bigger boat from Jaws. You know, it's so if we were the species that spoke in metaphors, you know, the Garden of Eden or Wizard of Oz or Jaws would probably make it into our language, kind of the way it really has, except for we don't have another species to communicate with so that they wouldn't understand, so we don't really realize it. But it is interesting how, without actually conveying the information you're conveying, you're only conveying information from something that you can both relate to, you transfer an understanding to another person.
And I know this is going to sound like it's off topic, but it's something I hadn't really considered before you said that. There's almost a part of me that wonders what role memes are now going to play. Because if you think a lot of the foundations for the memes are this picture, and a lot of times the pictures are based in something that is easily culturally identifiable. And even if it's not, it becomes easily identifiable within a culture, at least with an online culture. And, you know, there are pictures that, you know, even if you did not see the text on it, what message is trying to be conveyed by a picture? You know, the old saying, a picture's worth a thousand words. But I almost wonder if memes are becoming like the old epochs.
Yeah, you know, as you were saying it, the sort of thing I was thinking of is that they're almost like the new, the modern, you know, comic strips. And when I say comic strips, I mean like maybe a political cartoon or something like that. You know, you could look at those like old drawings that are making some point about, you know, a president or a war or something. But you just look at these pictures, even if you don't read the text, you kind of know where it's going. And the other thing too is, you know, you and I have kids around the same age. When I see my kids talking to each other, even with their friends, they'll make a reference to a meme that if you didn't know the meme, you would have no idea what they're talking about. But they know it because they both know the meme. It might be a viral video, even it might not necessarily be one picture, but they'll make some reference to it. But it's like something everybody knows. So I'm kind of sitting here, if I'm lucky, I know which one they're talking about. But, you know, sometimes it's almost like they're speaking another language. I understand the words, but I don't understand what they just said to each other because I don't have that common reference with them.
So going back to the Star Trek episode, we're like Captain Picard, especially with the age difference of us and the alien. And we don't even understand, you know, one generation removed from ourselves because they are speaking in terms that we can't identify because we don't experience or have not experienced those particular cultural references.
That's right. You know, and here's a funny one, and we're going kind of in a rabbit hole in just this, but it's too interesting to leave alone. You know, we still say go the whole nine yards, but almost nobody understands. Now we understand the meaning of it, but we don't even understand the origin of it anymore. The meaning itself has carried past the time when anybody knows what it means, but it was a reference to World War One when you would go 9 yards and dig another trench. You know, you go the whole 9 yards to start the next trench. And it's like, nobody really even knows that anymore, but it's like the meaning outlived the reference. So we all know what it means to go the whole 9 yards. But at the time when they were saying it, they could just say, no, you know, don't half-ass this. Let's go the whole 9 yards. They understood what that meant because they experienced the origin of it, if that makes sense. Now, we have not experienced the origin of it, and most of us don't even know the origin of it, but the meaning of it has become so ubiquitous that we know what it means without even knowing where it came from.
So it becomes timeless, almost like some of these stories.
Exactly.
What's interesting, I actually had a conversation, I think it was yesterday even, or maybe the day before, with one of the people we work with, and you're bringing up the whole nine yards, and that's a reference that I didn't even understand, but he was talking about piss poor, and being so poor, not having a pot to piss in, and I'm right. Like, you understand that, do you know the meaning or the origin of that? It's like, well, no. It's like, well, a long, long time ago, people would sell urine to tanners as a way to get a few pennies. And if they didn't have a pot to even piss in, that was obviously even poorer because they could not get that little supplemental income, or dirt poor, meaning they did not have an actual floor in their house. It was just dirt, or even raining cats and dogs, where the cats used to go up into the thatch roofs because that was the warmest area. But when it would rain, they would get soaking wet and they would start, of course, dropping down out of the thatched roof. And these are other examples of things that I don't think many people living here, or at least that are listening to this, are probably living on dirt floors and pissing in pots to get a couple of pennies to survive.
Right. Yeah. I didn't know any of those things, but yeah, when somebody says those things, I know, I know what they're conveying. Because yeah, it's like the meanings of those statements have outlived the actual understanding of the reference.
Man, that's awesome. Again, I didn't think we were going down this road, but that's pretty typical for you and I. So
yeah, it is.
I'm going to grab the steering wheel and get us back on track. And we were talking about the pattern recognition machines that are our brains. And, you know, a lot of times these machines are working in overdrive. Most often it's when we don't know the answer to the question, why? And I would make the argument that some of the most incredible stories, maybe even surrounding creation or our roles in the cosmos, have derived from that.
Oh yeah, for sure. You know, it's one of those funny things. It's kind of unimaginable to us now, but you know, say you were alive back then, say you were around before we had, you know, maybe not before we had, writing, but let's just say it was, you know, you would maybe have direct knowledge, that you had parents and that maybe they had parents. But you know, you'd have to imagine like how many people were here before me. And I think it would have been easy to imagine that it was like, oh, okay, maybe we're five or six generations into this thing. And, you know, where did this all come from? And it, like you say, as a pattern seeking creature, you would probably be looking around and you would derive meaning or answers, that weren't really there because we overcompensate for finding patterns so much to the point that we see patterns and we see meanings in places where there are none, if that makes sense.
No, it absolutely does. I can put myself or try to put myself in those shoes. And, you know, I would have to wonder sitting there wherever there was, and literally the only thing you have to go on are the stories that have been passed down, because we're talking about predating written language. You may have pictographs, you may not. And I mean, if they draw like I do, God knows what kind of pattern you would see in the drawing.
Yeah, same here.
But, you know, the oral tradition obviously predates language, but
or writing, you mean?
Predates writing. And I would have to believe that you look around in the natural world and everything, like you said, comes from something else, a parent of some sort, a birthing agent. And at some point you would go, okay, well, how far back does this go? And what created the first one? If everything is required to have something bring it forth into this world, what brought forth the first into this world?
Right. You know, and it's funny because it's almost like unless you're really advanced and you have, you know, ways of, you know, measuring and gathering information that we only really have sort of in the modern era. You know, I was just sitting here kind of as we're talking, I was doing what I've done before and kind of done that little thought experiment with myself about, you know, let's say I'm one of these ancient humans. And I thought, okay, well, as an ancient human who lives a lifespan of, you know, maybe 35 years, I would probably see a couple of trees die. And then I'd look around and see maybe there were already some dead trees. So I would have to almost conclude reasonably that maybe, you know, we're only a few generations of trees old, the whole world, or else there'd be a bunch of dead trees and a bunch of dead animals and a bunch of all of these signs of antiquity. But for the power of observation they had, that was unaided by, you know, our instruments and our methodologies and science. There's really no anything that is a sign that the world is very old, or that, you know, many, many generations of many, many things have happened before. You know, if you saw strata in rocks, you would have no idea that that means those rocks are millions of years old. You would just think that's the color of those rocks. But I know what it looks like when a tree is dead, but I only see a few dead trees, you know, for example. So you really had no reason to think that you're just a little blip in a very long history. You know, you would kind of have to think, okay, well, I know that, you know, my great grandpa maybe, or my grandpa told this story, so maybe he was there. And the stories carry through better than other things, like we said, because it's like they have this universal, we can relate to them universally. So it's like they have the power to survive through generations.
Yeah, and most of the stuff that was created by these early generations did not survive several generations. There was no
Great
Pyramid or monuments or the Easter Island statues, whatever you call it. There was nothing that would survive multi-generational other than maybe tools. But even then, you're talking 1 to 2 generations removed. So, I mean, that's an excellent point. There's nothing evidentiary, at least for these people, to make them wonder how far back does it go. And even then, I would have to, if I put myself in those shoes, I would want to be less removed from the first people, the progenitors of humans, because that would mean I'm closer to the creator.
That's right. You know, and we kind of do that today, right? I mean, you hear people say they'll try to relate themselves genealogically to great figures. They'll say, oh, you know, I'm actually the great, great, whatever, you know, granddaughter of George Washington or whatever. It's like we have this, it's like we have this drive to connect ourselves with, you know, great figures or great events. Even though we weren't even there, you know, it's like we didn't even do it. This is something another human did who happened to reproduce, who happened to make us, you know. So no, we kind of see a version of that even today with the way that we behave today.
Absolutely. And even if it's not with an individual, a great individual, I think even more great cultures, there's this large push to find out where you're from, what your makeup is, as if that has anything other than maybe melanin content to do with who you are today.
Exactly right. one of the things that I say a lot in conversations about these things that is maybe not popular, but I'm being genuine when I say it. And that's when I say, I don't understand ethnic pride. I don't understand it. I don't think that there's two sides to this coin. You know, there's like ethnic pride and there's ethnic shame. And I don't understand those things, because how is that a reflection on me as a person? You know, because the genetic makeup of the people who procreated that I am a result of, that there was no choice made by me there, and it doesn't say anything about who I am as a person. You know, how I treat my friends, how ethical I am, how's my sense of humor, you know, all of these things. It says nothing about those things. So I don't understand either, you know, wearing that on my sleeve and being proud of it, or conversely, you know, apologizing for it. You know, there's a lot of those two things kind of that go on a lot, you know, shame of ethnicity and also pride of ethnicity. And those are things that I don't quite understand, because on the shame side, the sins of people who have done things who look like me are not a reflection of me. Conversely, the great things that have been done by people who look like me are not my accomplishments either.
I know we already walked away from this topic, but I can't help but sit here and wonder if this is not more of our pattern recognition machines in overdrive trying to categorize people and predict behaviors based on who they're related to, who they came for. I mean, at best, you may get an indication of predisposition for genetic disease, like heart disease, things like that, but other than that, I can't think of any reason why we should be predisposed to looking at where a person's from, where they come from, as any indicator of who that person is and will become.
That's an excellent, excellent point. I would have to think that's spot on. You know, I would have to think that it probably, you know, goes back to a time. There was probably a time that was advantageous. You know, if the next tribe over was a little different genetic pool, then you're competing with that tribe. They might be easily identifiable by, you know, maybe the way they look. You know, maybe it was attached earlobes or lighter skin or darker skin or whatever. But, you know, since your tribe is in conflict with that tribe, you see somebody with that trait and you kind of identify them as, you know, a competitor at best and an enemy at worst.
No, that makes absolute sense. And I guess I need to apologize. We lied, or at least I lied at the beginning. I said this was going to be a little bit of a lighter one of our episodes, and it appears
we can't help it.
No, we can't help ourselves. It's our pattern recognition machines going into overdrive, unfortunately. But no, I think you're spot on. There was a time and a place where it was advantageous to identify, especially predating more universal languages like we have now. The amount of languages, I would make the argument, have decreased.
As we're more interconnected. Yeah, we're more interconnected. So, you know, there's less isolated pockets that would sort of evolve their own languages in a metaphorical island. You know, you look at creatures on islands and they evolve differently from creatures on the mainland. And I think languages sort of evolve in a very similar manner. You know, you isolate a language for a very long time, and just the common vernacular is going to evolve independently of, you know, we'll say the continental vernacular. And so, you know, they end up being very different, probably eventually to the point where they're unrecognizable to each other.
Like the Aussies and the UK, for instance.
Yes, very good example. Yeah.
No, that's definitely a good point. I mean, and the fact that the experiences of the culture are so deeply embedded in language, like we spoke to before, there's no reason to believe that it would not be that way. One will drag us back. This is an interesting topic. It may be something we dive in even deeper in another episode. But as promised, we want to talk about The Wizard of Oz. But before we delve too deep into the movie, I want to take a break to hear from our sponsors. But while we are away, I challenge you to do one thing for me. I want you to take a moment. I want you to think about what you remember from the movie and if anything spoke to you in a meaningful way. We'll be right back. All right, guys, welcome back. And before we get too deep into at least the meanings that Cole and I were able to pull out of the movie, I was going to let Cole kind of walk us through the movie, what happened, a very brief synopsis, if you will, for those of you that may not have watched it, or maybe it's been a while.
Right. So, you know, the story starts out, there's just this, this young girl, in the movie. She's played by, what is her name again? Judy Garland. When they filmed it, she was like 16 years old. So kind of imagine a girl about that age. She lives on a farm in Kansas, and it kind of opens to, she's running home. There's a woman who's coming who is mad at her dog. And she loves this dog. The dog's name is Toto, and she's going to take the dog, because the dog messes up her garden. So she's kind of going to all these people. She goes to her aunt, and she goes to kind of some of the farmhands looking for help. And they're all kind of too busy for her, and they're like, don't worry about it. But then the woman, whose name is Mrs. Gulch, shows up with an order from the sheriff to take the dog away because she claims the dog bit her. She takes the dog. The dog escapes, runs back to Dorothy. And then, you know, she wants to run away with the dog to sort of save the dog, to not have it escape. So she runs away. She meets this. He's kind of one of those traveling huckster types. His name is Professor Marvel. And he's sort of one of these kind of mentalist magician huckster type of guys. And he really quickly figures out what's gone on. But even though he's kind of a shady character, he's also got a good heart. So he basically tricks her, talks her into going back home. But in the meantime, the storm has whipped up. There's a tornado. By the time she gets back to the farm, everybody is gone into the shelter. So when she goes back home, the house is empty. Window flies off of the house, hits her on the head, knocks her out. And then the whole house gets picked up by the tornado. And she lands in another world. She lands in the land of Oz, where it's sort of this very like fantastical, magical type of world. But when her house landed, she landed on the Wicked Witch of the East. And, you know, so the Munchkins, who are the people who live where she landed, they're happy about it because, you know, she was a wicked witch and she was sort of their tormentor, their, you know, despot, if that makes any sense. A good witch shows up, explains everything that's happened. She wants to go back home now. So they tell the witch tells her, well, you have to go see the Wizard of Oz, and he can get you back home. So she leaves, and on the way to, the Emerald City, which is where Oz, the Wizard of Oz, lives, she picks up three friends. One of them, the first one, is he's a scarecrow. He's a living scarecrow. You know, he can walk and talk. And his complaint is that because he's made of straw, he has no brain. So she's like, okay, well, the wizard can probably help you too. You know, come with me and Toto. I'm trying to get home. You need a brain. We'll travel together, solve both our problems. So they go a little longer, they pick up their next companion in this journey, and he's called the Tin Man. He's a man made of metal, but he's rusted shut because he was out there chopping wood. It rained, he rusted solid. They oil him up, and his complaint is because he's made of tin and he's like hollow, that he has no heart. So same with the Scarecrow. They say, come with us. Wizard of Oz could probably help you too, get you a heart. So on with their journey they go. They pick up their last companion, who is the lion. He's called the Cowardly Lion. They pick him up in the woods, and at first they're terrified of him because he's kind of a bully, because he's a coward inside. He's trying to scare them, but they figure out he's, you know, kind of a big softy, and he wants courage. So like the previous two, he joins their journey to go see the wizard, and they make it all the way to the Emerald City, and they see the wizard, and the wizard tells them, I'll help you if you bring me the broomstick of the Wicked Witch of the West, who is the sister of the witch who Dorothy killed with her house. Well, I can't say Dorothy did it. The house landed on her when she landed in Oz. And so they have to go try to get it. On their way there, Dorothy gets kidnapped by the Wicked Witch because she wants the slippers that were on her feet. Now, I should have explained this earlier. The magic slippers that were on Dorothy's feet were originally on the witch who got killed by the house. She wants them really bad because they're magical and powerful. We're never told why she wants them so bad. The Wicked Witch of the West kidnapped Dorothy to try to get these slippers. She can't take them off. Dorothy has to voluntarily give them over. But the other three companions, this stops becoming a mission to get the broomstick, and now it becomes a mission to rescue Dorothy. So they go, they find her in her castle. The Wicked Witch of the West tries to start the Scarecrow on fire. And in doing so, Dorothy, trying to save the Scarecrow, throws water on the Scarecrow to put out the fire. The water hits the Wicked Witch. That makes her melt and kills her. And so they take the broomstick. They go back to the wizard. And he grants their wishes, but we'll get a little deeper into kind of the deeper part of that. But he gives the Scarecrow a diploma. He gives the Tin Man a clock that's in the shape of a heart. And he gives the Lion a Medal of Honor for bravery or something, you know, a medal for bravery, like a war medal. And then he is going to take Dorothy back to Kansas in a hot air balloon, which is the means that he arrived in Oz. He's actually from our world too. And the balloon has, you know, State Fair of Omaha on it. So, you know, we get the impression that he came here accidentally, just like she did, through the sky. But Toto jumps out of the balloon right before it leaves to chase a cat. Dorothy chases after Toto. The air balloon takes off. She misses her opportunity. So she thinks, until the good witch shows up again and said, "You had the power the whole time. Just click your heels together, say there's no place like home, and you'll arrive back home," which is what she does. And she arrives back in her bed with all of her aunt and those farmhands surrounding her. And, you know, they say, "Oh, you just had a dream." And she's like, "No, it wasn't a dream. It was real." And then the credits close. And that's a quick synopsis of the story.
Yeah. And there's quite a bit to unpack there. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with some of the roles that I took out of it for some of the individuals or things I picked up on. And we can kind of go from there and see what I grabbed and maybe see what speaks to you. Now, for me, the obvious one, Dorothy. Dorothy represents yourself in this story. This is who you are in this journey, whatever framework we want to put this in. The wizard, to me, was imagined authority, which could be secular or non-secular in nature. The Scarecrow, Lion, and Tin Man represent parts of what we consider being human, with the exception of intelligence. Bravery, courage, and heart are traits that I think are very human. But to me, the intelligence that spoke to me from this story was the knowledge of oneself. Kind of like, what is that, Descartes, "I think, therefore I am"?
Yes.
The Wicked Witch, obviously the antagonist in this story, to me represented our animal nature, our primitiveness, trying very hard to stand in the way of reasoned progression. The Flying Monkeys, self-doubt, superstition, I mean, they were even demon-like, and fear, trying to prevent the same. Basically, that's what the witch was using to stand in our way of self-progression. The Yellow Brick Road, which was a major component within the story, was reason, the path to progression, and the path to truth. Like they said, I don't know how many times in the movie, follow the Yellow Brick Road.
Mm-hmm.
Ruby Slippers, perseverance in the face of adversity. They must be very powerful indeed, which is something the good witch, I think her name was Glinda, said. You know, the Wicked Witch, if she wants them, they must be very powerful. Perseverance.
That's exactly what she says, yeah.
Perseverance is what keeps us on the path of reason. Even what we find can often be terrifying. And then last but not least, Toto, to me, represented hope, which is what the witch wanted to destroy. Hope is what helps us stay the path when everything else, you know, it's kind of going south. But it, to me, it's the glue that holds everything together, because without hope, we can't be human. Without hope, all this other stuff is all for naught.
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought up the Toto thing, because I think it's easy to miss when you watch it that basically this entire story is driven by Dorothy's love for this dog. Mm-hmm. I mean, if not for the dog, none of it would have happened. She the whole reason why she ran away, the very first conflict was over this dog. And it's the reason why she went back. It's the whole reason why she ran away to you know, keep her relationship with this dog intact. It's also the reason why she missed her chance to leave Oz when she wanted to leave Oz, because you know, Toto hopped out of the balloon to chase a cat, and she jumped out of the balloon, even though the wizard was saying, like, no, don't go, it's happening, we're going, I can't control this thing. But she wasn't going to give up. It's like she would rather be stuck there with Toto than to make it back home. So yeah, the importance of the dog. Oh, and one other thing too is when they confront the lion, Dorothy does not stand up to the lion until the lion goes after Toto. So when the lion is terrorizing her and the Tin Man and the Scarecrow, it's not until he starts antagonizing the dog that Dorothy slaps him on the nose and says, you know, how dare you? How are you going to pick on this little dog? So yeah, I think you're right in that it's a Toto represents something more important than it would seem on its face, because Dorothy's love for Toto really actually is the whole sort of linchpin for the story.
It absolutely is. And one other thing, if I remember correctly, and I haven't watched the movie in years, wasn't it Toto that revealed the nature of the wizard, the false nature?
Absolutely. That's exactly right. So if you don't remember, or maybe if you saw it a long time ago as a kid and didn't catch it, all of the main characters except Glinda the Good Witch that are in Oz actually exist in Dorothy's normal life in Kansas. So the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Lion are actually played by the same actors, and in Oz are representative of those people in her life, of those three farmhands. The Wicked Witch of the West is Mrs. Gulch, who was going to take her dog. The wizard is that Professor Marvel, who she met when she ran away. He's kind of this, you know, it's kind of a benevolent huckster in both Kansas and in Oz. You know, all of these people are sort of the same characters. Mrs. Gulch was like this, you know, metaphorical wicked witch in her real life. The three farmhands were these, you know, flawed but good-hearted, you know, companions of hers in her real life. And Professor Marvel, who plays the wizard also, is that sort of, you know, he's a huckster with a good heart. And that carried into her experience in Oz. She overlaid these characters in her real life to these characters in Oz.
Yeah, she absolutely did. And one of the things that I, obviously, you know what I'm going to key on, one of my big pet peeves is authority, especially authority that should not exist or does not exist. And for me, I know you're using the term benevolent, good Lord, I can't do it again, with regards to the wizard, but sitting here listening to you and looking at it from the role of authority, secular or non-secular, the wizard is what sent her into danger. I mean, literally the lion's den, if you will, pardon the metaphor there, against the witch. And all because, I mean, whatever reason you want to extrapolate from it, but I have to wonder, you know, if you could overlay this artificial authority or non-existent authority that compels us to do things that we should not do.
Yeah, I have a thought on this. If we're only talking about the wizard, what's funny is, you know, when they arrive in the city, the guy who answers the door, you know, the guy guarding the door, is also played by the same actor who plays the wizard. So we don't, as viewers, we don't know, but I suspect that that's supposed to be the same guy. So the actor who plays the wizard and plays Professor Marvel back in Kansas, he actually plays two characters in Oz too. And I suspect that that was kind of intentional, that he's also kind of out there living among the people, we'll say. But he tells them nobody has ever seen the wizard. So what's interesting is when they go into his, you know, chamber or whatever, there's this big disembodied head and it's scary and green and it's supposed to, you know, terrify them and also scare them into doing what he wants. Now, in reality, he really doesn't have a need for this broomstick. It means nothing to him. He's just trying to prevent himself from being exposed. But the interesting thing to me is once he is exposed, when they go back the second time, Toto runs over, sees this old man running these machines. And once the jig is up, then that's when you see his good side. And it's almost as if it's like he was a good person the whole time. It was the authority that made him do bad things, not just authority does, you know, like authority over people is not justified, but even that it corrupted him as a human. Because once the jig was up, he was all benevolent. He only actually was doing things for them from that point, if that makes any sense. It's like once he lost his air of authority, you saw the true him that was uncorrupted by the authority that he had.
No, that's an excellent point. I had not even considered, but that I guess fits with what we see on a day-to-day basis. When you take an average human being and put them in a position where they have authority, they turn into something altogether different. Now, don't get me wrong. I understand there's humans that are out there that are naturally bad, that are naturally evil and will seek out power. But what's the old saying about power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely?
Right. Yeah. I don't know if it's an intentional statement, but whether it was intentional when they made the movie or not, this is one of those definite, you know, you could take this message from it, because yeah, he was basically kind of a tyrant to them when they were afraid of him. But once everything was up, he was just this sort of regular guy, who was nice and would help them. But when he had the authority and they were afraid of him, he sent them on. I mean, I kind of have to suspect it was really just supposed to be an impossible mission, mm-hmm. to get them out of his hair so that he would not be exposed for what he really was.
Yeah, I think you could definitely pull that, and you could maybe even look at him as being the unknown and our fear of the unknown, and the way we conquer it is realizing that there's no need for the superstitious overlays or these grandiose overlays on the unknown, that the reality is often more benign or more benevolent than we often believe.
Sure. There's an interesting thing. So I talked about, you could tell I was kind of wishy-washy when I said he helped them. He really did genuinely try to help Dorothy get back to Kansas, mm-hmm. in the hot air balloon. But what he, you know, when I was given the synopsis, I said, you know, he gave the Scarecrow a diploma. He gave the Tin Man a clock that was in the shape of a heart. And he gave the Lion this Medal of Honor. Now, we all know, and it is pretty clear on its face, that he didn't actually give them what they were asking for. And there's a song by America my dad used to listen to a lot. And I don't remember the name of the song, but the chorus line, it is, you know, Oz never did give nothing to the Tin Man that he didn't already have. And when I watched it through this last time, which was last night, what I realized was that actually the things that the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Lion, the things that they were seeking they actually had, not just they had it, but it was actually their strength. So, you know, immediately upon meeting the Scarecrow, when you kind of pay attention, the Scarecrow is the one with all the clever, he's the one who comes up with the clever ideas the whole time. He thinks he's stupid and has no brain, but he's the one who, for example, has the idea of stealing the uniforms of the witch's guards to sneak into the castle. You know, he was the clever one, and the Tin Man was the actual sensitive and empathetic one, and the Lion really was kind of the brave one. Because here's the funny, the thing, and I think this is an important distinction. Bravery is not just doing the things that other people are afraid to do. Bravery is doing what you are afraid to do. You know, so if I'm not afraid of spiders, I'm not brave if I kill a spider. But if I am afraid of spiders and I kill a spider, then I actually showed bravery. So the Lion could not be brave without fear. The fact that he overcame his fear, he was the only one with all this fear, but he overcame it at every step. So the Lion was the bravest, the Scarecrow was the cleverest, and the Tin Man was, you know, the most empathetic and sympathetic. So it's almost like this whole story, and Dorothy wants to go back home. So it's like what I always missed was that all of these characters actually self-actualize. It was what they didn't have was that belief in themselves as to who they were, if that makes sense. Oz didn't give the Scarecrow brains. He gave him a diploma so that he could accept that he's smart. The Scarecrow brains, right. The Lion was always brave, but he couldn't believe it until he had the medal pinned on him. And the Tin Man always had a heart. He just couldn't believe it until he got the little heart-shaped clock. And Dorothy, you know, in the beginning, when she's back in Kansas, she sings the song Over the Rainbow. Everybody, I think, even if you've never seen the movie, you probably know that. And it's like she's fantasizing about going somewhere else, getting away, going to some fantastical place. But once she gets there, she realizes what she had at home and only wants to go back, and then finds out that she had the power the whole time with her own 2 feet. And it's like all of these characters, they actually had what they were seeking the entire time. It just took them realizing it for themselves, if that makes sense.
No, and I'm glad you picked that up. That's something I never grasped upon whenever I watched the movies. And the thing I'm struggling with, and I don't know where I'm going to fall with this, is that, like you were saying, each one of these individuals had the power of self-actualization, and they had inherent within themselves the one thing that they were seeking the entire time. But looking at the wizard who was going to grant her the thing she wanted most, going back home in a hot air balloon, which obviously didn't work, but she had the power within herself. Was the power the slippers, do you think, or was it literally her own 2 feet?
I think it was sort of, I think it's more impactful to think of it as her own 2 feet. But the sort of thing that really hits with me is sort of that fact that it was kind of in that moment when she really, because if you think about it, when she lands in Oz and she just wants to go back home, she had sort of this hope the whole time that this was just temporary. She was going to go see the wizard. She was going to make it back home. Then she was going to get on the hot air balloon. She was always going to make it back home. But once the hot air balloon was gone, that's when I think she really thought, okay, I'm never getting back home. And then that in that moment that she really, really gets that everything she wanted was at home, and like because it really hit her at that moment, I think that's sort of why that's the moment when Glinda reveals you could have done it the whole time, is because she needed to realize it for herself the same way that the other, her three companions needed to realize it for themselves. So it was a realization is sort of why that became the moment that she could just click her heels together and go back home, is because, you know, that they couldn't just hand her a deed to her house, because what she really wanted was to be home. And I don't think she really appreciated what she had at home until that moment, because at that moment, that's like kind of when she thought, okay, I'm really never getting back. Because the whole time she kind of, in the back of her head, I think she knew she was going to get back until the hot air balloon took off. And then she thought, okay, I really am never getting back. Hmm.
I can definitely see where you grab that. That's kind of a cool way of looking at it. For sure. You know, in that moment, she wanted, the thing she wanted most was home. Now, home represented in one instance, kind of a physical location, the farm in Kansas. But when she wakes up, the thing that she's happiest to see, at least to me, are the people that played a role within this story that played out in her mind, the farmhands and her family.
Exactly right. I agree. Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily the physical location. I think it's, you know, at the beginning of the story, like I said, when she arrived and she's freaking out that Mrs. Gulch is going to come get her dog, you know, it's like she's going to these people, and because they're really busy. I mean, they're literally working this farm. I think she kind of felt blown off by them. And that's why, you know, she kind of did the young kid thing and was like, well, fine, you know, nobody here loves me. I just want to go to a land far away, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, if you think about it, the whole journey for all of these people it was a physical journey, but the real journey, the meaningful journey was a realization, a journey of realization, you know. Dorothy realizing that basically everything she wanted was actually at home. It was not in a land far away. She had everything she wanted. She just didn't realize it. The Scarecrow was clever. The Lion was brave. And the Tin Man did have a heart. You know, and it took them this whole journey, while physical, wasn't the important part. That was the sidebar. The actual important journey was the self-realization.
Yeah, that's definitely an interesting take. Now, one of the things, I'm going to take a quick segue here, that kind of struck me looking at this story when you and I were first discussing doing this episode was, you know, the first thing that pops out with my pattern recognition machine is this belief in authority. You know, she lands in this place, doesn't recognize anyone, just killed a witch, and she probably honestly didn't even believe that witches existed before she landed in this new culture or this new construct, if you will, but immediately accepted what she was being told about an authority that honestly, if any of us walked around in life and we had a problem and someone said, well, you just need to go see the Wizard of Kansas or the Wizard of the US or whatever. It doesn't really matter what the name is, I guess. We would just, you know, laugh at him and go, there's no reason why I would believe that we have this one thing that can solve all of our problems. But yet you take a step back and realize that that's exactly what we do with religion and government.
Absolutely. Right. So, that's absolutely what we do when somebody, you know, you just hear somebody complaining in normal life and, you know, they'll say, oh, well, there ought to be a law, you know, or they'll pray, you know, they'll say, you know, I'll pray for you or whatever. It's like, we do have, a Wizard of Oz or two in our lives. And we want those. We want that wizard to solve our problems for us. And that's another cool parallel here. And maybe this is where you're going. If you were going, I don't want to steal it from you. But what's cool about this is, you know, you go through this journey with them and you find out they didn't need the wizard mm-hmm. to do it. They just thought that they did. They had the power the whole time. They had everything they needed. And the wizard was literally an illusion. When he had authority, he was literally an illusion.
No, that's exactly where I was going with that. You know, whether it be the Wizard of Nazareth or the Wizard of Washington, it's all illusory. It's a mm-hmm. construct that, and I guess you can make the argument, and I could see this, that just like in the case of the Wizard of Oz, where the wizard is the one that furthers their journey, or at least is the reason for the journey, I guess you could make the argument that religion, or maybe even whatever benevolence you believe the government does, that there's some good that comes out of the bad, if that makes sense. But I think we could get there without it. Now, there's those that would make the argument that without the wizard putting them on the path to kill the Wicked Witch of the West, they would have never self-actualized. Now, whether that translates to what we experience as humans here in the real world, if you could call it that, I don't know.
Yeah. You know, there, it's one of those funny things. Do you give, is it fair to give the wizard credit, I guess, in this circumstance, you know, cause that was not his intention. It would be almost as if I said, you know, hey Sean, can you run to the gas station and get me a sandwich? And then while you were there, you just happened to pick up a winning lottery ticket. Now, do you really owe me any thanks or owe me anything because I sent you on a completely unrelated task to that you ended up getting something out of? I mean, it's hard to give the wizard credit for, you know, what happened because they confronted the witch. Because, like I said, it seems to me all he wanted to do was keep up the illusion. You know, the one character says there's nobody's ever seen the wizard. And, you know, the other really famous line that you hear, you know, we all kind of know what it means, but it's literally what he says when he's controlling the big disembodied head, is when Toto pulls the curtain open, he says, you know, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. That's sort of one of those things that's made it into our lexicon. When we say that, we know what we mean. But everything about him was, all of his calories, I guess, were being burned on keeping up the illusion. So, you know, that's why he sent them on that task, was kind of to get rid of these meddling kids who were going to uncover his plot. And they just happened to trip upon useful things in it. It's hard for me to give the wizard credit.
No, and I would not either. But I can think of many people that, if we take it to the real world, like we're talking about, that, well, because I prayed for you, you got a promotion, or because you gave your tax dollars, your child does well at school, however, whichever. And right. I would take the exact same vector there, that I don't grant them any credit. Oh, I could also think of people that, let's use your example of sending me to the gas station, where if I would have gotten hurt, or let's say I went to the gas station to get you a sandwich and the place got robbed, there are people that would blame you. Well, you know, I would have never, ever been robbed if I hadn't have done this for you. But the reality is, you did not cause or create this problem.
Right. Exactly. I think we definitely tend to do, we tend to give these imagined authorities a lot more credit. And, you know, I think in the time and in the place that we live, it's easy probably to relate it to government. But, you know, rewind 1,000 years and you see that it was much more so with deities. You know, because if it was a volcano or a thunderstorm or a plague or famine, you know, the only answer was, you know, God was mad. You know, so definitely giving the credit or giving the agency to events that had nothing to do with it, to this imagined authority.
Yeah, and to kind of end where we're going with that, I picture in my head, you know, okay, well, the gods are angry. We need to sacrifice some human life to throw at this problem.
Exactly. Well, and is that different than what we do? Then, you know, we'll say the religion of state. You know, how many people have we, you know, quote unquote, sacrificed to please the state? How many people have gone to war? How many civilians have gotten shot by police officers? You know, how many people die to not anger the god slash state?
It's uncountable. You know, like you said, how many people have been sacrificed to solve a problem that's not solved by sacrifice? It's immeasurable. Well, I feel.
Yeah, it just.
No, go ahead. Finish your statement.
I was just going to say, you know, hundreds of millions, you know, in the 20th century, especially. I mean, that was a relatively secular century, but that didn't stop the death toll because we found a new imagined authority.
I have to wonder, and I can't remember if you and I have talked about this, but I kind of want to leave this thought hanging with the listener. I have to wonder how many people, and again, unmeasurable, but how many people in our history have died due as a direct response to some form of tribalism, whether it be religious base or whether it be government, versus the amount that have died just from purely natural causes. I bet the percentage would be surprising.
I think it would too, especially, you know, there was, I saw some statistic one time, and it was like, if you were a Russian man born in, you know, like 1922, it was something like this, but it was just a horrifying statistic. It was, I'm not getting this perfectly right, but it's close enough to drive the point home. It was like, if you were a Russian man born in 1922, you had a 20% chance of being alive in 1946. Because so many Russian men died fighting the Germans in World War II. That basically that generation of males was not completely erased, but almost rendered ineffective. The population decreases still echo every 20 years to this day in Russia, because you had this generation of men who were not there. And then when it's time for when they would have had kids who were having kids that don't exist, the population shrinks again. And then when the kids of those kids that never existed would be having kids, the population shrinks again. So the population of Russia is like this beating heart ever since World War II, because so many died in World War II that it echoes the population. There's these echoes of population decrease in Russia to this day.
That is staggering. Well, since that was such a pleasant and positive note to end on, do you have anything else you want to wrap this up with?
I think the only thing that I kind of would like to add that's kind of a neat thing about the movie is, you know, these characteristics, and you touched on it too, is, you know, you had Dorothy who wanted to go home. But then you had these other three characters who felt that they were insufficient in these three different, you know, very human characteristics, if that makes sense. And, you know, this is sort of one of those things for, I feel like, everybody. Whatever it is that you feel you're insufficient in, wherever it is you want to go, or whatever it is you want to accomplish, you know, that power, the good message from this movie, I feel like, is that power's in you. But you have to go do it. Nobody's going to do it for you. No authority is going to do it for you. It's all an illusion. Even if you do it, it's because you did it. Don't give the authority the credit, because the wizard didn't get Dorothy home. The wizard didn't make the lion brave. The wizard didn't give Tin Man a heart, and the wizard didn't give Scarecrow intelligence. They had those things. They just needed to realize it for themselves and act on it.
That's an excellent point. That's definitely a much better way to wrap it up. I was scared we were going to end on this Russian thing. It's like, oh God, Greg, we're going to have a bunch of people walking away depressed. But no, that's a very good point. We all possess the power, but we literally just need to go on the journey. And the journey does not have to be physical. We've talked about where you and I came from, ideologically, and then, myself coming from a religious, very strong religious background, we have the power to self-actualize if we are willing to persevere down the path, use reason, and realize that what we need in our lives comes from within and honestly from each other, because it did require the Scarecrow, the Lion, and the Tin Man to help her get out of her predicament. So it's not purely individual. We as humans have to work together and utilize our individual strengths in order to accomplish amazing things. But Cole's absolutely right. Attributing it to any form of authority is wrong, in my opinion.
Yep, that nails it. Perfect.
Well, thank you guys so much for spending some time with us. I know we were all over the place in this episode, but that seems to be the norm anymore. We greatly appreciate you spending the time with us. Don't forget to leave us a review, rate us, subscribe. Make sure you tell other people about us. We would absolutely love to hear from any of you. If you get a chance, we have a Facebook page as well. So until the next episode, we'll see you then.